House come to order. Would the members please register their presence by voting? As we'll wait for Mrs. Byrne to make the dash. Any member failed to register their presence, clerk may take the quorum.
Present, 1 absent.
Mr. Miller.
Speaker, I'll move and ask unanimous. No one's excused from the call of the House today. I'll move and ask unanimous consent that any absent members be shown as excused on official state business.
No objection. So ordered. Please rise for prayer by Reverend John Tyndall, the Northern Light United Church.
Almighty God, ruler of nations, give us the ability to measure what is urgent against what is enduring and timeless. Give us then the patience to do the small duties and routine tasks of the poor, the confused, the sick, the ignorant. We pray in the name of the one who came among us as a carpenter. Amen.
Mr. Parr.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent to prayer be spread on the journal.
No objections, so ordered. Brings us the introduction of guests. Are there guests to be introduced to the House? Mr. Rossi. Mr. Haugen. Any other guests for introduction? The clerk have messages from the governor.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. Dear Mr. Speaker, conforming with past practice, this is to inform you that all legislators have been granted a 60-day extension on filing their state income tax returns. I should like to point out, however, that when you do file your state income tax return, you should note that this extension has been granted. With respect to extensions of time for filing federal income tax returns, which are due on April 15, 1976, applications will have to be made on an individual basis. I am informed that a supply of federal applications for extension of time to file federal income tax returns has been distributed to each chamber of the legislature. Signed sincerely, J.S. Hammond, Governor.
The clerk certified to the correctness of the previous day's journal.
As chief clerk, I certify as to the correctness of the journal for the 93rd day.
Speaker, I'll move and ask unanimous consent this body approve the journal as certified by the chief clerk for the 93rd day.
No objection, so ordered. Does the clerk have other messages from the governor?
No, Mr. Speaker.
Does the clerk have messages from the other house?
The Senate has adopted the free conference committee report on committee substitute for Senate Bill number 310 amended, and House committee substitute for committee substitute for Senate Bill number 310 amended by the House, leaves of absence for auxiliary members of armed forces. Thus adopting free conference committee substitute for House committee substitute for committee substitute for Senate Bill number 310.
Mr. Bradley. House will be at ease. House come to order. Does the clerk have other messages?
The President has appointed the following members to a second conference committee with powers of free conference to meet with a like committee from the House to consider Senate Bill number 334, enabling a mutual bank to invest in property improvement note not in excess of $10,000. And House Committee substitute for Senate Bill number 334 relating to housing, property improvement notes, and security deposits. Senator Rohde, Chairman, Senator Curtula, Senator Sackett.
This is an old pending free conference committee. We'll appoint a committee under unfinished business. The clerk have other messages?
I have no further messages from the Senate, Mr. Speaker.
Clerk have general communications?
No, Mr. Speaker.
Does the clerk have committee reports?
The Committee on Judiciary has had committee substitute for Senate Bill 157, Labor and Management, relating to Public Employment Relations Act, under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Gardner, Chairman, concurred in by Eliason, Specking, Cotton, and Bradley. Signing do not pass, Gardner, Parr, and Brown. Committee substitute for Senate Bill 157 has no further referral. The Committee on Finance has had Senate Bill 285, making a supplemental appropriation to the Department of Health and Social Services, Alaska Retarded Citizens Association Work Activity Center, under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it be replaced with House House Committee substitute for Senate Bill 285 and that it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Malone, Chairman, concurred in by Cooper, Greening, Haugen, Naughton, Itta, Duncan, and Buchholz. Senate Bill 285 has no further referral. The Committee on Rules has had Senate Bill 296 amended relating to the Alaska Integrated Bar Act under consideration. Three of the members of the committee recommend it be replaced with House Committee substitute for Senate Bill 296 rules and that it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Parker, Chairman, signing do pass, Naughton, Cotton, and Parker, having no recommendations, Specking and Miller. Senate Bill 296 amended is on today's calendar. The Committee on Labor and Management has had Senate Bill 630, exempting apprenticeship programs from age discrimination prohibitions under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Smith, Chairman, concurred in by Urien, M. Byrne, and Smith. Huntington has no recommendation. Senate Bill 630 has a further referral to Judiciary. The Select Committee on Education has had House Resolution 5, urging the purchase of Alaska Methodist University under consideration. Four of the members of the committee recommends it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Parr, Chairman, signing do pass, Osterbach, Davis, Swanson, and Parr. Having no recommendation, Ostrowski, H. Byrne, and Hackney. Signing do not pass, Wallace. House Resolution 5 has a further referral to Finance. The Committee on Judiciary has had House Concurrent Resolution 109, requesting the Alaska Bar Association to publicize the Attorney Fee Review Committee under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Gardner, Chairman, concurred in by Eliason, Gardner, Brown, and Specking. House Concurrent Resolution 109 has no further referral. The Committee on Labor and Management has had House Concurrent Resolution 118, relating to preferential hiring of Alaska residents under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it do pass with attached amendments. The report was signed by Mr. Smith, Chairman, concurred in by Urien, M. Byrne, Smith, and Huntington. House Concurrent Resolution 118 has a further referral to Judiciary. The Committee on Resources has had House Bill 654 relating to the administration of state lands under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 654 and that it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Anderson, Chairman, concurred in by Anderson, Smith, Rode, Huntington, and Brown. House Bill 654 has a further referral to Finance. The Committee on Judiciary has had House Bill 786 relating to faculty smoking areas in public schools under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee report it back with individual recommendations. The report was signed by Mr. Gardner, Chairman, signing do pass, Gardner, and Parr. Having no recommendation, Bradley and Cotton. House Bill 786 has no further referral. The Committee on Commerce has had House Bill 720 relating to the Motor Safety Responsibility Act under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee reports it back without recommendation. The report was signed by Mr. Bradley, Chairman, concurred in by Wallace, Fisher, Urien, Rudd, and McKinnon. Signing do pass, Bradley and Kelly. Signing do not pass, Freeman and Rode. House Bill 720 has no further referral. The Select Committee on Education has had House Bill 868, making a special appropriation to the Office of the Governor, under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 868 and that it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Parr, Chairman, concurred in by Ostrowski, Osterbach, Davis, Swanson, and Parr. Having no recommendation, H. Byrne, Hackney, and Wallace. House Bill 868 has a further referral to Finance. The Select Committee on Education has had House Bill 885 relating to the Public Employment Relations Act under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 885 and that it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Gardner, Chairman, concurred in by Parr, Ostrowski, Wallace, H. Byrne, Swanson, and Davis. House Bill 885 has a further referral to Judiciary. The Community and Regional Affairs Committee has had House Bill 906, making a special appropriation to the Department of Community and Regional Affairs for the subsidy of housing and cottage homes under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 906 and that it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Cotton, Chairman, concurred in by Cotton, O.C., Davis, and Kelly. Having no recommendation, Rudd, Hackney, and Freeman. House Bill 906 has a further referral to Finance. The Select Committee on Education has had House Bill 909, making a special appropriation to the Department of Education for construction of a school at Anderson under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Parr, Chairman, concurred in by Ostrowski, Osterbach, Davis, Swanson, and Parr. Having no recommendation, H. Byrne and Hackney. Signing do pass, Wallace. House Bill 909 has a further referral to Finance. I have no further standing committee reports, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Specking.
Speaker, may we revert to
Without objection, we refer to introductions.
Mr. Speaker, in the RIB, I see an old friend, Mr. Provident, the director of the Farm Home Administration, Mr. Terry Cole.
Any other introductions at this time? Clerk, have reports of special committees.
Mr. Speaker, the Conference Committee with Powers of Free Conference, which has had committee substitute for Senate Bill Number 310 amended, leaves of absence for auxiliary members of armed forces, and House Committee substitute for committee substitute for Senate Bill Number 310 amended by the House under consideration, recommends that Free Conference Committee substitute for House Committee substitute for committee substitute for Senate Bill Number 310 be adopted. Was signed by Senate members Rader Chairman Chance and Bradley, House members Bradley Chairman Guy and Hershberger. I have no further special committee reports, Mr. Speaker.
Clerk, have introduction of resolutions.
House Concurrent Resolution Number 31 by the Select Committee on Education, relating to extension of school bus routes.
Referred to education.
House Joint Resolution Number 69 by the Rules Committee, relating to the Vessel Documentation Office in Sitka.
State Affairs.
I have no further resolutions for introduction, Mr. Speaker.
Clerk, have introduction of bills.
House Bill Number 911 by the Resources Committee, an act relating to compensation for improvements on certain federal land subsequently patented to the state.
Resources and Finance.
House Bill 912 by the State Affairs Committee, an act relating to a driver licensing medical advisory board.
State Affairs and Judiciary.
I have no further bills for introduction, Mr. Speaker.
Brings us to the daily calendar. The clerk read the first item on the calendar. House will be at ease. House come to order. Clerk read the first item on the calendar.
Sponsor substitute for House Bill Number 823 by McKinnon, an act providing for state chartered credit unions. The Committee on Commerce has had sponsor substitute for House Bill 823 under consideration. Two of the members of the committee recommend it be replaced with committee substitute for sponsor substitute for House Bill 823 and that it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Bradley, Chairman. This reported back within two. Bradley and McKinnon signed do pass. Signing do not pass, Freeman and Rudd, Urien and Rode. Signing do not pass, or having no recommendation, Kelly. The Committee on Judiciary has had sponsor substitute for House Bill 823 under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for sponsor substitute for House Bill 823 Judiciary and that it do pass. Report was signed by Mr. Gardner, Chairman, concurred in by Gardner, Parr, Bradley, and Cotton. Having no recommendation, Brown and Eliason. Signing do not pass, Specking. I have two committee substitutes on my desk, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Miller.
Mr. Speaker, I'll move and ask unanimous consent that the Judiciary Committee substitute be considered in lieu of the original bill.
There no objection. The Judiciary Committee substitute is adopted. Will the clerk read the First Amendment? We have seven so far.
Amendment number one by Mrs. Fisher. Page one, line 22. After the word character, insert the following. And substantiates the economic advisability of establishing the proposed credit union, comma.
Mr. Speaker, I move
The amendment.
Objection is noted. Mrs. Fisher, you have the floor.
Thank you. This is the exact language that's in the federal credit union bill. And I'll have to speak a little bit on the bill in order to explain the amendment. But the bill leaves it pretty wide open as to the type of people that could form credit unions, such as on page 2 under A, credit unions shall be open to groups having common or related bonds of occupation or association, or to residents of a well-defined neighborhood, community, district, or to employees of related or industries, or to members of bona fide fraternal, religious, cooperative, labor, rural, educational, or similar organizations. So it leaves it pretty wide open as to, you know, if you got six greenhouses, you can start a credit union, as to who could start one. And I do think that it should be left up to the Commissioner of Commerce whether or not it's feasible, whether or not it's economically advisable for a credit union to start, you could have all of a sudden, say, 100 people in, 100 different organizations in Juneau, or people in one block, another block, if you want to stretch your imagination, all want to get together $1,000, that's all they need, and start a credit union. Well, you'd have a disastrous situation. And I do think that there is nothing wrong at all that they should have to go to the Department of Commerce, and that the commissioner should have the right to have the authority to determine whether this is economically feasible or not. You can overdo on anything, and I know that in the now this is just like a bank, and in the situation of banks, I'm sure it'd be much more lenient with credit unions. But in the situation of banks, a bank can't be established unless the director of banking decides that it is economically feasible to have another bank in that location. And I think you're just going to have credit unions running out of your ears unless you establish the feasibility for the union. And I would hope that you would support my amendment.
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Speaker, one question to Representative Fisher. I would like to know where it says in the statute that banks, you have to prove the economic advisability or feasibility of the banks. I wasn't able to find that myself. In fact, conversation with Commissioner Motley and the director, ex-director of Division of Banking, Mr. Schlossberg, they indicated that they felt that there had been a problem in the past years because there are these vague standards in the statute that allow for abuse of discretion, and that there has been a problem in past years with establishing banks in the state because there's this broad language that nobody knows what it means, and you can just basically turn down anybody that applies, in this case, for a bank, and that had been done in the past, and they introduced a bill to correct that situation that's now in the Senate. And we tried to ask everybody what this economic advisability means. I mean, it's some kind of terms. I'm sure everybody here has an idea of what it means. It's two words of the English language. But as to legal meaning, what does that mean? What do you have to do to prove economic advisability or feasibility? Nobody, none of our attorneys or anybody from the department could tell us what that exactly meant. So what we attempted to do was to tie it down to more specific things that don't just allow one person, in this case the Commissioner of Commerce, to decide what that means. There's all kinds of requirements in here that you have to conform with, and you'll see there that where we put in language that says consistent with provisions of this chapter and regulations of the Commissioner of Commerce. And so these things have to be specified as to what they mean, instead of just putting in a vague criteria at the outset that somebody has to meet. And there's all kinds of requirements in terms of insurance. And that's probably the most critical one. You have to obtain insurance before you can do anything with a credit union. And only insurance available is through the federal government. It's a similar program to FDIC now. And you have to obtain this insurance. And these are specific things that you must meet, not some vague criteria that one bureaucrat can decide what it means. And we felt that that was a better way to determine whether a credit union ought to be organized and how it ought to be organized than that vague criteria.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you. Well, an answer to your question as to what is economically feasible as far as the banks are concerned. For instance, I know that if a branch bank is applies in an area and there's already a branch bank there and the population will not handle more than one bank and have that bank being a paying institution, they don't grant a charter to the next bank. And I cannot understand why you would have disapprove of this when you just mentioned the Federal Credit Union. I imagine we'll hear it time and time and time again today. But this is part of the Federal Credit Union statute. And I'm certain that with a few holes on this, they're going to have a lot easier time getting insurance. If they know, if from the an insurance company, if they know that the Department of Commerce feels it's economically feasible that this credit union be started.
Representative Sullivan.
Mr. Speaker, could we have the amendment read again, please?
The clerk, we read the amendment.
Page 1, line 22. After the word character, insert the following, and substantiates the economic advisability of establishing the proposed credit union, comma.
So any other discussion? We'll have roll calls and all the amendments, I think, that measure of controversy. Question is, shall amendment number 1 pass the House? Members may proceed to vote. Has any member failed to vote? Clerk may close the roll. Does any member wish to change his vote? Clerk may take the roll.
Yeas, 22 nays, 1 excused.
Amendment fails. Clerk, read the next amendment.
Amendment number 2 by Mrs. Fisher. Page 5, line 12. After instruments, delete the semicolon and insert to its members.
I move the adoption of the amendment.
Objections noted. Mrs. Fisher.
Well, I'll tell you, if this one doesn't pass, it's because it's all wired. Because if you'll look on line 9, assess charges to its two members in accordance with the bylaws, and then again on line 15, perform trust services for its members. All along you're talking about its members. So I, under sell traveler's checks, money orders, or other type instruments, I just added to its members.
Representative Gardner.
Mr. Speaker, I'd certainly support Mrs. Fisher's amendment. I think it's she just caught an oversight of the Judiciary Committee.
Representative Miller.
Speaker, I can assure everybody there's nothing wired, but I just don't see anything wrong with the credit unions being able to sell traveler's checks. Any travel agent in the United States can sell traveler's checks. If I wanted to, I could sell traveler's checks. Why in the world shouldn't we allow a credit union to make a couple of bucks off of selling traveler's checks?
Question is, shall amendment number 2 be adopted? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Amendment's adopted. We excluded that one. Clerk, read the next amendment.
Amendment number 3 by Mrs. Fisher. Page 20. Lines 10 through 12. Line 10. After the word of, delete the property securing the loan and insert the following. A 1 to 4 family residence. Line 12. Delete 30 and insert 10.
I move the adoption of the amendment.
Objections noted. Mrs. Fisher.
Well, this is the real guts of the whole bill as far as I'm concerned, as far as the thing that really should be changed. And again, to explain the amendment, I'm going to have to go into a little bit past the credit unions, how they were originally formed by companies or organizations in which few people could band together and deposit money on payday, receive a relatively high rate of interest from their savings, and those that weren't quite as frugal would be able to borrow for their personal consumer types items. I know because my husband belonged to a credit union at Tugatch Electric, and this was a union where on payday they'd go and probably add $20-$25, and then when somebody got hard up, they'd borrow it out. So by necessity, they have borrowed short and lent short. By that I mean 30, 60, 90 days. That's usually been the terms of a credit union. Real estate mortgages are long-term mortgages, and the pattern of investment and deposits of credit unions does not lend itself to covering these long-term debts to short-term deposits. Here again, now, all I'm thinking about is depositor protection. And I could see possibly what they have to pay on demand. And now in this bill, if you haven't read it, they can start up for $1,000. A bank to start up has to have $2 to $3 million. I don't know whether, I know it's $2 million on the national banks, a recent one that I knew that started, but I think it was $3 million on some other banks that I'm aware of. And but here you've got a little outfit starting with $1,000, and you're going to allow them to go into real estate loans, and you're going to allow them to go into 30-year loans. Well, as a result, well, take the credit union, right? I know it's in good shape, the Federal Credit Union, because I understand it has about $117 million. And it's now all along the pipeline because these people are considered federal workers, many of them, because they are working for the federal government, or the federal government is paying part of their pay. So they do belong. As I say, I'll give this as an example. However, I do know that this credit union is a safe credit union because they have built up for many, many years. However, they could not go into 30-year loans right now and just rid of all their money, because as a result, when the pipeline workers leave that are now in the credit union, they're going to draw out their money, and they've got to have that money available. And here you're giving a small credit unions, which I think these will be small credit unions, the ability to handle 30-year leases to sell homes or businesses on real estate for 30 years, just exactly like a bank. Of course, as Bill has, everything but the bank. I mean, they have all the privileges of the bank without any protection. But I would like to see that cut to 10 years. Then if a union is healthy enough, they could give 10-year loans on 1 to 4 family residents. But I don't think they should go into the real estate business.
Any other discussion? Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Speaker, it has really amazed me, this whole business about whether credit unions should be able to make home mortgages. The controversy kind of came up in the committee when, with different people testifying, the administration and representatives of the banking industry. And in fact, Commissioner Motley sent me a letter after the bill was passed out stating that he says, with one serious exception, I think you have created a financial entity that would afford better services to the public throughout the state of Alaska. If such powers to make real estate mortgages in excess of 10 years were removed from the bill, I would support it wholeheartedly. Now, this is fine. A lot of times we have disagreement on issues and they come before a committee, and so you try to find out the facts of the situation. I ask the same question of every witness, including the sponsor of the bill, as to get some information to resolve this controversy, because I didn't know. Well, the people who are making the argument that Mrs. Fisher made have never presented one fact that I know of that demonstrates that they're right. On the other hand, Mr. McKinnon submitted information to the committee that 27 states now allow these very same home mortgages. And in fact, a couple cases in point, the state of Massachusetts has 360 credit unions, $1.5 billion worth of assets, and 35% of their loans are in long-term home mortgages. And they've had, their loss experience has been very little, and they are even doing these as primary lenders. They're not selling them to a secondary market, which even all the banks in Alaska do. They don't hold them as primary lenders. And yet, still, they are able to operate without going bankrupt or having large losses or all their deposits being taken out, as some people have said might. I think this is a manufactured opposition. There's just no basis for the opposition. I think there really is a problem. Maybe some people feel in their communities that everybody can get home loans that wants them, but I know in my community it's really tough to get a loan to buy a house. And if we can offer one more alternative that's a safe one, that's backed up by all kinds of regulations and insurance mechanisms and requirements as to how many home mortgage loans they can make, I think we ought to make that available to the people of the state. And until somebody can offer me one fact, I just have to think that this whole issue is just a bunch of baloney.
Mr. McKinnon.
Then
you may respond.
I wanted to respond to Mr.
Mr. Speaker, as Mr. Gardner has pointed out, there is no real evidence to insinuate that for some reason credit unions won't be able to handle mortgage loan powers. A bill is currently being considered by Congress which would give to federal credit unions these very same powers. And I'd like to read from the report of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee when it considered that bill. And part of it reads, federal credit unions are currently making real estate loans within the existing 10-year loan maturity limit. Last year, Congress enacted legislation permitting them to make mobile home loans with maturities up to 20 years for VA-guaranteed loans. In addition, approximately 26 state laws now permit state credit unions to make long-term real estate loans. So credit unions in general have had considerable experience in the mortgage lending field. In view of the pressing social priority for housing, the committee deems it appropriate to grant federal credit unions the powers to make long-term first lien mortgages to their members for their residences on terms consistent with those of other mortgage lenders. As the report points out, 26 and now 27, Nevada has recently passed a state credit union law. 27 states allow their states to make long-term mortgage loans. And as Mr. Gardner said, I've checked with several of those states. As he pointed out, Rhode Island allows credit unions to make these long-term loans. And credit unions there have developed a fairly sophisticated secondary market in which they do sell loans to insurance companies, Fannie Mae, local savings and loan associations who have surplus capital to invest. And they term their loss record insignificant. Massachusetts, as Mr. Gardner said, has 35% of its $1.5 billion credit union assets tied up in long-term loans with no secondary market whatsoever. They hold those loans for the term of the mortgage. And the credit union director there said he can only vaguely remember credit unions suffering any losses. He said he could probably dig up the statistics, but he doubts that if in the last 15 years they've come anywhere near $50,000. In Indiana, which just recently gained long-term mortgage powers in 1970, there hasn't been a great demand for credit unions to provide this service because apparently local savings and loans associations are adequately meeting the needs there. In Washington, I talked to a man named Bill Young, who was director of credit unions there, and oddly enough, is an Alaska native from Ketchikan, whose mother served as Secretary of the Senate during the 40s and 50s. And he went on to say that there are 200 credit unions in the state. 40 are large enough to invest in long-term real estate loans, and they do. So far, there's $36 million invested in long-term loans, all held as primary lenders, although credit unions there are now just beginning to develop secondary markets. And he terms his losses also insignificant. So the record is that in 27 states, credit unions are doing this, and they're doing it so well, in fact, that Congress is considering allowing federal credit unions to get into this area. So there are just no facts whatsoever to substantiate the opinion that credit unions can't handle long-term mortgage loans.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you. I want to see a credit union bill go through. I think we should have one on the books. And I would like to continue on with the letter from Mr. Motley that he read. He said, with one serious exception, I think you've created a financial entity that would afford better services, et cetera, et cetera. And if such powers to make real estate mortgages in excess of 10 years were removed from the bill, I could support it wholeheartedly. I will continue on with the letter. Without the removal of that portion, I feel compelled to advise the governor that such a provision addressing a problem that has neither been proven nor qualified and potentially could be dangerous to the depositors of the financial institutions of the state should merit his serious consideration for a veto. I am truly hopeful that you will be able to amend the bill accordingly and allow this vital structure to perform the services for which it was intended. I would certainly hate to see the credit union bill vetoed because you were too damn stubborn to bring it back to where it made sense.
Representative Bradley.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I guess if the other less worthy states of the union, 27 of them to be exact, can handle this with the membership and vis-a-vis the population of our state. We can certainly handle it on a par with any of those states. In fact, we'll be the best. And speaking on the commissioner, this guy came with his hired counsel with a little clouded record in the first place, stated his full conceptual support of the bill, and it wasn't until agonizing work by the sponsor, hours and hours and hours, that he finally got the cue from the industry that, in fact, the major point was the mortgage provisions in this bill, which he then started to specifically attack that in private. And I don't think this body should be intimidated by the Commissioner of Commerce on this issue.
Point of order.
Mr. Brown.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker. With all due respect to Mr. Bradley and Mrs. Fisher, aren't the motivations of the Commissioner of Commerce or any prospective action by the executive not proper debate on this floor, the same way that we are not to take into consideration in debate matters regarding the actions of the other body?
You're correct, Mr. Brown.
Thank you. Speaker.
The motives of various people testifying and the members will be presumed to be in the best character. Mr. Malone.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I am confused trying to follow this debate on this amendment. It was stated by Mr. McKinnon that in the U.S. Congress, the committee's declared that housing has a high social priority, and I think that's generally recognized in Alaska and in the state legislature. And if this mechanism in the legislation as it currently exists provides for more opportunity for home mortgages and for housing for the people of the state, why should it be taken out of the legislation? The facts that Mr. Gardner is talking about, the facts in support of the amendment, I don't really think have been brought out. And if someone can come up with specific reasons, for supporting the amendment, I'd like to have a chance to evaluate them. But to say that it's simply not a good idea, I don't follow that. It seems like it is a good idea to me to make more opportunities for housing available in the state. And so I'd like to know what the facts are on the other side so that we can make a judgment on those facts.
Mr. Speaker, I fear the 10-year because I don't know how large each one of these credit companies are going to get. None of us can even visualize what they're going to be, whether they're going to be very small or very large or whatnot. But they start out with $1,000. Well, I don't, at the end of the year, say maybe they have, I'd have to guesstimate on anything I said, but maybe they had $50,000. They couldn't put many 30-year loans out for $50,000. And remember, they have to keep 10% in reserve, where the banks have to keep a 35% reserve on hand. So I think what I'm trying to say is that this money has to be available. You invest in a credit union. If you want to withdraw that money, you can withdraw that money on demand. If they have taken most of this money and put it in that long a term loan, when people demand their money, it isn't going to be there. And you're going to see one credit union after another fold up. And it's going to create a chaotic condition in the state.
Mr. McKinnon.
Mr. Speaker, obviously, credit unions with only $50,000 worth of assets aren't going to be making long-term mortgage loans. And it's not intended that they do so. The provision is in there for the larger credit unions so that once they have sufficient financial assets, they can make available to their members long-term mortgage loans. That's all that provision is in there for, and it's not going to be done by the smaller credit unions without adequate assets. In addition, there are adequate provisions in the law for the commissioner by regulation to require additional reserves for those credit unions that are into long-term mortgage loans. So there's really no problem with it.
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Speaker, the committee was not unaware that there should be some restrictions on the lending, and in, for instance, we added one thing in addition to some 30-odd amendments we put in for Commissioner Motley, that on page 19, we tied it down to improve real estate because the committee thought that if what we wanted them to do was to get into, allow them to get into housing, that we shouldn't just allow it to be, the loans to be made for property, that that's a lot more speculative and there you don't have a mortgage on a house. And so we put that in. And other requirements, such as in the section that Representative Fisher is amendment applies to, down the bottom line, you see that 50%, that their total in loans for real estate may not be in exceed 50% of the paid in capital of the credit union. And then all these various insurance requirements, besides insurance requirement on deposits, and all the other reserve requirements, plus the authority of the commissioner to require these unspecified special reserve requirements. We just felt that there's all kinds of protections that are probably in some of them in excess of what we require of any other of our financial institutions. And we felt that that was the way to tie the problem down, that some people think that the credit union might have poor management. And that's what we felt was a better alternative than just prohibiting them getting into the housing market. Because if you only allow them 10 years, nobody is going to be able to buy a house and pay it off in 10 years with today's cost of housing and interest rate.
Mr. Parr.
Mr. Speaker, I might also add, in addition to other safeguards, that if members look at the bottom of page 27, I'll quote that, a director, officer, or employee of a credit union who knowingly approves or permits the funds of the credit union to be invested or loaned in an excessive, careless, or dishonest manner is personally liable for all damages, et cetera. So not simply negligence or something of that sort, but loaned in an excessive manner is liable. I think that that would certainly discourage me if I wanted a board of directors of a credit union and was starting to lend out too much money.
Mr. Malone.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. If what the amendment contemplates is something like a run on a credit union equivalent to a run on the bank, well then certainly the amendment doesn't accomplish that purpose, it seems to me at least. It doesn't make any difference if money is tied up for 30 years or 10 years. If it's tied up, you can't get at it. And so I don't see how that would, changing the term down to 10 years would do much except to limit the service to the people that need the housing. But it was already brought out on the floor, I think, that these credit unions, the sophisticated ones, do sell the mortgages, and so that the amount of cash that they have on hand to meet some sort of sudden demand, seems to me they would be able to have it. In addition, if adequate reserves are required, I don't see a problem, and I the basis of the arguments can't support the amendment.
Mr. Graney.
Mr. Speaker, I think what Representative Fisher is concerned about is the security to the depositors. And one of the safest investments a bank can make is in housing. It's been shown that the last thing a person defaults on is a loan on his house. Default on a car loan, many other areas, but this has been shown time and time again to be one of the safest investments. So if there really is a concern in this regard, I would think that the amendment would be directed to some other area. But as Representative Gardner has pointed out, there are a lot of safeguards in those areas. But housing loans are one of the safest things these credit unions could be making.
Is there any other debate? Question is, shall amendment number 3 pass the House? The members may proceed to vote. Does any member fail to vote? Clerk may close. Members may, clerk may close the roll. Does any member wish to change his vote? Mr. Naughton. Clerk may take the roll.
Nine yeas. 30 nays, 1 excuse. 9 yeas, 30 nays, 1 excuse.
Amendment has failed. The clerk read the next amendment.
Amendment number 4 by Mr. Urien. Page 18, line 25. Delete, the rate of interest may not exceed 1.5% per month of the unpaid balance, inclusive of all charges incident to making the loan.
Mr. Urien.
I move and ask unanimous consent for the adoption of the amendment.
Objections noted. Mr. Urien, you have the floor.
Mr. Speaker, according to Legislative Affairs Agency, this amendment really makes it clear that the credit unions would be under the same usury statutes that the banks are. And it doesn't really do any harm to the bill. As you know, this language is a confusion of whether they're allowed to charge 18% for a home mortgage or 9.5% like any other bank. And the Legislative Affairs Agency feels that they would only be allowed to charge the 9.5% as anyone else under today's rate. And this amendment makes that clear.
Mr. McKinnon.
Mr. Speaker, I have no real objection to the amendment in that credit unions often, or more often than not, loan considerably below the legal limits. So I don't think the amendment would do any real harm to the bill.
Mr. Green.
Can we have the amendment read again, please?
The clerk, we read the amendment.
Amendment number 4 by Mr. Urien. Page 18, line 25. Delete. The rate of interest may not exceed 1.5% per month on the unpaid balance, inclusive of all charges incident to making the loan.
Mr. Greening. Oh.
Mr. Speaker, if I understand the amendment, then it would take the top limit out. Generally, usury statutes wouldn't apply to certain kinds of loans, and I have no objection to the amendment, but it doesn't seem to accomplish what the proponent says it does.
Mr. Gardner. House will be at ease. House come to order. Amendment number 4 was still under debate. In order to clarify the situation, I will ask the clerk to reread the amendment.
Amendment number 4 by Mr. Urien. Page 18, line 25. Delete, the rate of interest may not exceed 1.5% per month on the unpaid balance, inclusive of all charges incident to making the loan.
Mr. Urien.
Mr. Speaker, due to the total chaos my amendment seems to have caused, I'll move and ask unanimous consent to be withdrawn.
Without objection, then the amendment will be withdrawn. Will the clerk read the next amendment?
Amendment number 5 by Mr. Urien. Page 18, line 14. After administrator period, insert, no dividend may be declared on shares which exceeds the interest that mutual banks may pay on passbook savings accounts, semicolon, interest paid on deposits may not exceed that which mutual banks may pay on comparable types of deposits.
Mr. Urien.
Move and ask unanimous consent for the adoption of the amendment.
Objections noted. Mr. Urien.
Mr. Speaker, what we're doing with this bill is giving credit unions the same authority as banks, and we're bringing them all in line so they can all compete with each other in various fields. One problem that I see with the bill is that credit unions under their charter are permitted to pay more interest on deposits than banks. All banks in the state, be their mutuals, savings and loan associations, state and national chartered banks, are regulated by the federal government under a thing that's called Regulation Q. And Regulation Q puts a ceiling on the amount of interest they can pay on savings deposits. Mutual savings banks and savings and loan associations are allowed to pay 0.25% higher than state chartered banks and national chartered banks, commercial type banks. And the effect of my amendment would be to put the same restriction on credit unions. If we're allowing credit unions to compete in the market, I think we should say that we shouldn't give them an unfair advantage. They're going to compete for deposits out there, And they could say, they could advertise, well, we can pay more. And I just feel that they should be brought under the same regulation as banks. And I urge you to adopt the amendment.
Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Speaker, I was just wondering, from the reasons given by the member for withdrawing his previous amendment, that to be consistent, if we react with total chaos to each of his amendments, that he will always withdraw them. I yield to Mr. McKinnon.
Mr. McKinnon.
Mr. Speaker, there is one major difference between banks and mutual banks and credit unions, and that is that mutual banks have unrestricted ability to compete in the marketplace for depositors, whereas credit unions are severely limited to a set group of people whom they can enroll as members. So that I think it's not unreasonable to give credit unions a slight advantage, since they're restricted with in terms of who they can compete for as depositors.
Mr. Urien.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. McKinnon's right. They are restricted as to who they can get deposits from. But we're passing a bill here that's going to open up credit unions. And you're going to have, you got the state employees credit union, you're going to have the, you got the Chugach Electric credit union, you're going to have the legislators credit union, you're going to have the housewives credit union, you're going to have the despondent husbands credit union. Everybody's going to be allowed to be a member of a credit union. So all I'm saying is, if we're all going to be eligible for some sort of a credit union, let's put us all in the same ballpark as far as competing for deposits.
Mr. Speaker, we are opening up credit unions, but we're not opening up the scope of membership. The provision in the bill is, the first portion of it, identical to the federal credit union definition of common bond. Second portion of that definition merely goes on to insert some clarifying language, and these fraternal, religious, cooperative, labor, rural education organizations, these people already have powers to organize credit unions under federal charters. So we're not opening up credit unions to any new scope of membership. We're just giving them additional powers. They won't have the ability to compete for people who don't comply with the common bond requirements of their charter.
Mr. Miller.
Mr. Speaker, there's one other difference as well that I think argues against the amendment, and that is that within a credit union, you're literally dealing with your own money. And even the loan committees, for instance, are not professional hired people in many, many instances. At least they're not in the federal credit union here in this city. They're made up of people who are themselves state employees, for instance. And they meet and consider the credit worthiness of applicants. And the result is that you're dealing with your own money. And if at the end of the year, Mr. Speaker, you find that you've handled your own money properly, I see nothing wrong with you being able to decide the basis of your dividend on that basis. It's almost as if the restriction that the representative from Anchorage has placed with this amendment would be that perhaps I myself, if I wanted to invest monies, I couldn't declare a dividend to myself at the end of the year. I couldn't decide how much I was going to allow myself for a new stereo set or something like that. When you're dealing strictly with your own money on the scale that the credit unions do, I don't think that they should be restricted in the same way that the commercial banks, who after all are out, and there's nothing wrong with this, you know, to make money.
Any other debate? Question is, shall the amendment pass the House? All those members may proceed to vote. Has any member failed to vote? The clerk may take the roll. Does any member wish to change his vote? Mr. Wallace. Any other member? The clerk may take the roll.
Nine yeas, 30 nays, one excused.
Amendment fails. Clerk, read the next amendment.
Amendment number 6 by Mr. Urien. Page 20, between lines 26 and 27, insert a new section to read, Section 640-265, Disclosure of Geographical Distribution of Loans. Insert body of committee substitute for House Bill 572, changing the words financial institution throughout the bill to credit union.
Mr. Urien.
I move and ask unanimous consent for the adoption of the amendment.
Object.
Objection is noted.
Mr. Speaker, I find myself in somewhat a difficult position. I can't really expound on the virtues of this amendment, but I thought possibly the main sponsor of the bill could. It seems to me that if we're going to require banks now to send in that these lists of where they made the loans, and now we're allowing credit unions to make home loans, we ought to keep our records straight and make them supply us with this annual report on geographic location of their loans.
Mr. Speaker, I have no objection whatsoever to requiring credit unions to do so. However, I think this isn't the appropriate vehicle to do it. I think the logical thing to do is amend the definition of financial institutions in the original bill over in the Senate, and I'd certainly support an amendment to that bill when it's considered by the Senate. However, although I'm not sure those provisions are applicable to credit unions, since by the very nature of their restrictions to common bonds, they perhaps wouldn't have members in certain neighborhoods, and I think it probably wouldn't apply, but I have no objection whatsoever to require them. I just think this is the inappropriate vehicle to do it.
On a point of order.
Point of order, Mr. Brown.
Mr. Speaker, if I remember the context of the bill that is sought to be inserted just as an amendment, that if the amendment is meant other than facetiously, the language of the bill would have to be changed in order to really accomplish the result, and I believe the member was sincere in making the amendment because he seems to be seeking parallelism between the requirements that are made of banks and the requirements made of credit unions. Can the language proposed in the amendment actually apply to the bill without some substantial changes to make it apply to credit unions?
I think the chair would rule that the subject of the amendment is certainly in order. It is very likely that structurally the amendment may be impossible, but if the sponsor would wish to try to revise the amendment in some manner to be sure that it complies with structural requirements, it would be in order. Mr. Urien.
Mr. Speaker, I felt that it would apply. I don't think there's substantial changes necessary, and I did want to take this opportunity to agree with Mr. Brown. I'm very sincere, Mr. Brown.
Sincerity, Mr.
Question is, shall amendment number 6 be adopted? The members may proceed to vote. Any member failed to vote? Clerk may take the roll. Any member wish to change his vote? Mr. Guy. Any other member wish to change his vote? Clerk may take the roll.
Yeas, 24 nays, 1 excused.
The amendment has failed. Will the clerk read the next amendment?
Amendment number 7 by Mrs. Fisher. Page 28. Line 11. After the word law, delete the remainder of line 11, all of lines 12, 13, and 14, and through and including the word that on line 15, insert the following, shall be subject to AS 437030. Line 15, a new sentence is formed starting with the word real.
Representative Fisher.
I move the adoption of the amendment.
Objection is noted. Mrs. Fisher.
Well, Mr. Speaker, knowing the shaky financial condition of the state right now and realizing that a good many of you are very much willing to tax, to add added taxes to the people. I felt that as long as the financial institutions of this state are going to pay taxes, and now the credit unions have all the rights of the financial institutions, I think they also should pay tax. And actually, this is just the tax that is on all financial institutions in the state.
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Speaker, I'm not a real authority on 4370030, but the way I read it, it would be kind of meaningless applied to a credit union. It talks about gross income, and income is filed with the Internal Revenue Code and such language. I think it's supposed to be an income tax, or that's the basis for the tax.
Tax on banks.
Yeah. But as I read it, it's based on an income approach and your profits. Well, I don't understand how this would apply to the credit union since they don't really have a profit.
Mrs. Fisher.
Well, I dispute the fact that they don't have a profit. The profit is paid back to the members. And I think that on any profit of an institution like this, which is in, you know, as I say, they have every rights of full banking, why shouldn't they be subject to the same taxes the banks are?
Representative Miller.
Speaker, well, of course, they don't have all the rights and privileges and activities of full banking. They won't have deposit boxes that they rent and make a profit on. They won't have checking accounts. They won't. As a matter of fact, under Mrs. Fisher's own amendment, they can't even sell a traveler's check to a non-member. The bank has a whole range of money-making activities that they make money off of, and of course they should pay taxes on those. But getting back to just the previous amendment and the statement I made at this time, at that time, Mr. Speaker, these are people using their own money. And of course, if at the end of the year they get a dividend check, then naturally they'll pay their taxes on those dividend checks. But the institution itself certainly is not entitled to engage in all the activities of a bank, and they don't make any profits as a credit union.
Mr. McKinnon.
Mr. Speaker, I think the amendment ignores the real nature of a credit union. Credit union is a nonprofit cooperative association, and it's not organized like a regular profit corporation. A profit corporation, in terms of financial institution anyway, is organized primarily to make money for its owners, doing business with the general public. There's a corporation, a credit union, is organized to meet the financial needs of its members, and it does business only with its members. Credit union does not pursue high income as other financial institutions do. It seeks merely to cover its administrative costs, reserve requirements, and to return a reasonable rate on its savings to its members. The federal government currently grants the tax exemption to credit unions. Even under the Financial Institutions Act, which is now being considered by Congress, which would greatly expand the power of credit unions, it still allows for that tax-exempt status. And I think the amendment is just inapplicable to credit unions. The fact is that whatever profits there are, if they're term profits, are distributed back to their members in terms of dividends on savings or refunds on interest. And every cent of that money that's distributed back to its members is taxable, whereas corporations have an exemption of $100 on the first $100 of profits on dividends. So every cent of credit union profits is taxable through its members. And I urge the members to defeat the amendment.
Mr. Brown. Clerk, we read the amendment.
Page 28, line 11. After the word law, delete the remainder of line 11, all of lines 12, 13, and 14, and through and including the word that on line 15. Insert the following: shall be subject to AS 437030. On line 15, a new sentence is formed starting with the word real with the capital R.
O30. Question is, should amendment number 7 pass the House? The members may proceed to vote. If any member failed to vote, clerk may close the roll. Any member wish to change their vote? Clerk may take the roll.
Ten yeas, 29 nays, one excused.
Amendment fails. Does the clerk have further amendments?
No, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Miller.
Speaker, I'll move and ask unanimous consent that Judiciary Committee substitute or sponsor substitute for House Bill 823 be considered engrossed, advanced to third reading, and placed on final passage.
There be no objection. Judiciary Committee substitute for House Bill number 823 is advanced from second to third reading, and placed on final passage. Would the clerk read the bill for the third and final time?
Committee substitute for sponsor substitute for House Bill number 823, Judiciary amended by the Judiciary Committee, an act providing for state chartered credit unions.
Bills before you for discussion. Mr. Urey.
Mr. Speaker, I have a question. Somebody can answer. On page 5, parent 17, these are things that the powers of a credit union says it may receive from its members or any other credit union deposits payable on demand and honor requests for withdrawals of these deposits in any form if the credit union maintains the reserves required by the commissioner. Does this mean that if at some time during their operation, during the course of the year, they may be low on their reserves and not be maintaining proper reserves, that they could not honor any request for withdrawal in any form?
Mr.
Speaker, what that means is that if the credit union maintains proper reserves, it's allowed to get into demand deposits. It doesn't at all mean that if a demand deposit comes in and if the credit union doesn't have proper reserves and they can't pay it, it doesn't mean that at all.
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Speaker, just as a matter of legislative history more than anything else, I wanted to ask Mr. McKinnon. Apparently, Mr. Urien's question arises really from the grammar of the sentence, and it's my understanding from this, and I'll ask Mr. McKinnon this, that the phrase, if the credit union maintains the reserves required by the commissioner, applies to the entire powers section in the first place. That is, the power to receive from its members demand deposits. Is that a correct interpretation?
Right. Yes, it is. The implication is that if the credit union maintains proper reserves required by the commissioner, they can assume the powers granted under Section 17.
Representative Redd.
Mr. Speaker, when this bill went out of the Commerce Committee, I signed do not pass on it. However, the amendments which have been added by the Judiciary Committee have satisfied my concerns, and I do plan to vote for the bill.
Representative Urien.
One other question, Mr. Speaker. Can corporations deposit money and a credit union?
Mr. McKinnon.
Speaker, under the terms of membership, page 2, line 26, says organizations or associations composed of individuals, the majority of whom are eligible for membership. So that an organization, and I assume that could apply to a corporation, whose composed of people who are eligible to join the credit union can join it as an institution.
Mr. Urien.
Then maybe Mr. McKinnon can tell me, can a corporation deposit money in a savings account in a national bank?
Mr. McKinnon.
I don't believe they can. Perhaps one of the attorneys in the body can help on the definition. The bill authorizes organizations, associations, societies, and co-partnerships to enroll as members, and corporations whose stockholders are composed primarily of these individuals. Right, it does allow corporations as long as the stockholders are members of, would otherwise be eligible for membership in the credit union.
Mr. Urien.
his last part was a little bit wrong, because the way I read it, only one or two people have to be a member. According to the multiple party accounts on page 13 and 14, means that the president and the treasurer were members of the credit union, they could deposit the corporation funds into a savings account, which I don't think they can in other banks.
So any other discussion?
Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Speaker, I again enjoy Mr. Urien's sincerity, and I think he's raising an issue that might be an important one with the bill, but I just don't understand it. I'm not really into banking law, you know, and whether Mr. Urien or maybe one of the other law members or members like him who is familiar with business situations can explain what he's talking about, maybe that could give us some necessary information on either voting for the bill or considering an amendment on reconsideration or something like that. What are you talking about?
A member may respond if they wish. Is there any other discussion? The question is, should committee substitute for House Bill 823 pass the House? The members may proceed to vote. Does any member fail to vote? The clerk may close the roll. Does any member wish to change his vote? The clerk may take the roll.
Yeas, 12 nays, 1 excused.
The bill has passed the House. Mr. Urien.
Serve notice of my reconsideration on committee substitute, sponsor substitute for House Bill number 823.
Your reconsideration is noted.
Speaker, may we be at ease?
House will be at ease. Read the next item on the calendar.
House Bill number 898 by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to toilet facilities. The Committee on Judiciary has had House Bill 898 under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Gardner, Chairman, concurred by Gardner, Parr, Bradley, Specking, and Eliason. Brown has no recommendation. I have no amendments on my desk, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Miller.
Speaker, in the absence of amendments, I'll move and ask unanimous consent that House Bill 898 be considered engrossed, advance to third reading, and placed on the final passage.
Okay, no objection. House, excuse me, Mr. Freeman. Objections noted.
I would ask that for the purpose of information that somebody explain to me on line one, on page one, line 15 to 18, where it says a person licensed to practice law in the state who on the effective
point of order.
898.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
I believe you're on the wrong bill, Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Speaker, maybe I should make it a point of personal privilege. I'm wondering about the comparison between toilet facilities and lawyers.
The confusion is understandable. But, we are on the toilet facilities bill. The objection is withdrawn, and the bill, House Bill 8. We are in second reading. Advancement has been objected to. Do you maintain your objection? Objection's withdrawn, and House Bill 898 is advanced from second to third reading, placed in final passage. The clerk read the bill for the third and final time.
House Bill number 898 by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to toilet facilities.
Bill's before you for discussion and debate. Mr. Urien.
Mr. Speaker, I understand that our elevator bill was brought about because someone got caught in an elevator. I wondered who got caught short.
Mr. Gardner? Mr. Brown is on his feet. Mr. Brown is acknowledging.
Mr. Speaker, I wanted to ask the sponsor of the bill, or the chairman of the sponsor of the bill, didn't we do something or other on the same subject last year? And aren't we just putting off somebody doing something forever, or what's going on?
Mr. Specking.
Mr. Speaker, that is correct. We did do something. What this attempts to do is to flush out some of the evil. last year's action.
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Speaker, I don't really know if anybody wants the bill explained, but something I know more about than credit unions. The deal was a couple years ago, Jeannie Chance had a bill in that the legislature passed. It was that the reason it passed was it was going to require the restaurants and bars and taverns to have toilets, so when people were downtown with their kids, they had someplace to use for a bathroom. And that was the original purpose of it. Well, then the department had these regulations. They started requiring one toilet for every 25 people, which the result of it would be would that probably half the restaurants, at least in my town, would be shut down, or they'd have to expand and build more bathrooms. And there really isn't a problem with those people. The problem is the people that have nothing. And so the bill still would require the people that have nothing to have some bathrooms, but it wouldn't require the people that already have them to have more. One lady in my community that has a really nice restaurant next to the boat harbor was really upset because there's no bathrooms now at the boat harbor, and all these people always come in and use her bathrooms, and now they're going to require her to have some more. And she was particularly upset since she'd been nice enough to allow the public to use hers. So it would require, though, that if there was any remodeling, that these people then require the regulations. But the real problem is that just the regulations are kind of out of line, and the Attorney General says that there is absolutely no authority to have any kind of grandfather clause. So that's what the bill does.
Mr. Guy, House will be at ease. House coming to order. Mr. Miller.
Mr. Speaker, one of our members, Representative Smith, is going to be speaking at noon today, and for that and other reasons, I'll move that this body recess until 1:15.
Recess until 1:15.
Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Speaker. Sponsor of the bill isn't on the floor. There he is.
Here he comes.
Okay. Now that he's here, I would just like to again answer the question from this morning that seems not to have been answered. What was the bill we passed last year on the same subject, and why do we need a new bill?
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Speaker, I apologize for not being here soon enough. I didn't have a jacket. But last year we passed a bill that extended a moratorium because I thought they were going to take care of the problem in regulations, and they kept insisting that they didn't have the power to write in regulations a grandfather clause. I still think they're wrong, but they refused to do it, so it became necessary to pass a bill to do it since they wouldn't change it to regulations.
Should read Mr. Urian's amendment that he passed up here. Mr. Urian?
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent. We return to second reading for purpose of specific amendment.
Clerk, read the specific amendment number 2. Number 1.
Amendment number 1 by Mr. Urian. Page 1, line 20. After inspections period, insert: these regulations shall also provide that all outdoor facilities be equipped with a crescent designed and cut by a member of Crescent Regents of America and Pacific, also known as CRAP.
You know, in fact, the origin of that word, there was nothing obscene about it, but the inventor of the flush toilet was an Englishman named Thomas Crapper. The term never evolved in England, but for some reason American GIs going to England in World War I fixed on the term and brought it home. We'll leave amendment out of order. There's no other Mr. Gardner. The clerk read the specific amendment.
Amendment number 2 by Mr. Gardner. Page 1, line 15. Delete on the premises.
Is there any objection to returning to second reading? Hearing no objection, we're back in second reading. Would you move the amendment, Mr. Gardner?
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that amendment number 1 be adopted.
Objections noted. Mr. Gardner.
Mr.
Amendment number two.
Amendment number two. Stand corrected. The reason for this amendment is something that Mr. Guy brought to my attention, that that on the premises might specifically mean the building, and for some of our rural areas where the any other area of state that might not have indoor plumbing, that this might be too specific, and if they have an outhouse behind, I think that they would be complying if that's all that they have available. So by removing that, we would prevent anybody down the Department of Health and Social Services to read it to mean that they had to have it inside their building.
Mr. Hackney.
Mr. Speaker, I would think that with the amendment in there, it would mean that if an owner or restaurant of a restaurant or a tavern had one at home, that he's home free.
Mr. Parr.
Mr. Speaker, that's true, except it does say for public use. He might not want to do that.
Mr. Urien.
It seems to me, in seriousness, Mr. Speaker, that there are some restaurants that are in shopping malls where they don't have the toilet facility right on their premise yet. It's down the hall somewhere, and this amendment would allow that to be legal without them having to change the way it is today.
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Speaker, a question. Mr. Huntington brought to my attention that the same wording appears on line 11 also on the premises and probably should be deleted too. How do we do this? Have to have an amendment to the amendment to return to second reading again, or what?
If it's equivalent with the same subject, Mr. Gardner, we are back in second reading. We could amend the amendment, as long as it's not a serious departure from the specific amendment.
Mr. Speaker, I'd move and ask unanimous consent to move the amendment on the amendment deleting on page 1, line 11, on the premises, same language.
Would the clerk write that into the amendment, and then Mrs. Sullivan.
Mr. Speaker, in all seriousness, I think deleting on the premises could lead to some confusion. Perhaps if someone knows the legal definition of premises, or maybe there's another word like property or something that might more adequately reflect what we intend in the bill.
Is there any other discussion, Mr. Gardner?
Mr. Speaker, with the volumes of regulation the Department of Health and Social Services already put out on implementing this bill, I don't think there's going to be any problem in them tying down where these are going to be required. And they do have broad discretion to say they shall implement this act.
Any other discussion? The question is, shall the amendment to the amendment be adopted? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
The amendment to the amendment passes. The question now before the House is the main amendment. Should the amendment be adopted? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. The amendment is adopted. Mr. Miller.
Speaker, I'll move and ask unanimous consent that House Bill number 898 be considered engrossed, advanced to third reading, and placed on final passage.
Question is, should House Bill 898, hearing no objection, House Bill 898 will be advanced from second to third reading, placed on final passage. Would the clerk read the bill for the third and final time?
House Bill number 898, by the amended by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to toilet facilities.
Bills before you for discussion. Question is, should House Bill 898 pass the House? Members may proceed to vote. Has anybody failed to vote? Clerk may close the roll. Does any member wish to change their vote? Clerk may take the roll.
Yeas, 1 nay, 2 excused.
House Bill 898 is passed the House. Clerk, read the next item on the calendar.
Senate Bill number 296, amended by the Judiciary Committee by request, an act relating to the Alaska Integrated Bar Act. The Committee on Judiciary has had Senate Bill 296 amended under consideration. The members of the committee recommend it be replaced with House Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 296, excuse me, and that it be reported out with individual recommendations. The report was signed by Mr. Gardner, Chairman, signing DuPass, Gardner, signing DuPass if amended, Parr, and Brown, signing Do Not Pass, Cotton, having no recommendation, Bradley, and Specking. The Committee on Rules has had Senate Bill 296 amended under consideration. Three of the members of the committee recommend it be replaced with House Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 296 Rules and that it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Parker, Chairman, concurred in by Naughton, Cotton, and Parker, having no recommendation, Specking, and Miller. I have two committee substitutes on my desk, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Bradley. House will be at ease. Rules Committee substitute. Is objection maintained? Mr. Brown.
I object.
Mr. Brown, you have the floor. Objection is noted.
Mr. Speaker, the Rules Committee substitute purports to interfere with the power of the Supreme Court of Alaska to govern the matters involving the Alaska Bar Association under what's called the Inherent Power Doctrine, which was originally established by Ray McKay, a case that of the several states, and it is a very ancient and accepted part of the administration of a court system of itself, that is, those who practice before the courts. Mr. Speaker, the rules attorneys, that is, people actually become admitted to practice before the courts. Mr. Speaker, it is constitutionally infirm and cannot be corrected by a provision at the end stating that we are exercising our power to abrogate rules by a two-thirds vote. Because, Mr. Speaker, Article 4, Section 15 of the Alaska State Constitution says, the Supreme Court shall make and promulgate rules governing the administration of all courts, period. It shall make and promulgate rules governing practice and procedure in civil and criminal cases in all courts, period. These rules, and that has been interpreted to mean only the second sentence, may be changed by the legislature by two-thirds vote of the members elected to each house. Mr. Speaker, we may not, by a two-thirds vote, change the rules governing the administration of all courts. And, Mr. Speaker, it is under that first sentence of that section of the Constitution that I believe that the Supreme Court of Alaska quite properly exercised its inherent power over the bar, following on a historical tradition that goes back to the practice of law before the Inns of Court, before the establishment of the American democracy. Mr. Speaker, I urge the members not to adopt the Rules Committee substitute.
Is there any other discussion? Mr. Miller.
Speaker, I can stand to be corrected because I'm certainly not an authority on constitutional law, but it seems to me that in this body we have several times done precisely what the Rules Committee substitute purports to do, and there's never been any question raised about it. The joint rules, about which there's no question, says, if a bill or portion of a bill contains matter changing a Supreme Court rule governing practice and procedure in civil or criminal cases, the bill must contain a section expressly citing the rule, noting the change is proposed. The section containing the change must be approved by an affirmative vote of two-thirds of membership. As I say, Mr. Speaker, what we're proposing to do may or may not be a good idea. I don't know at this stage of the game until I hear more debate, but it seems to me that we've done precisely that many times, and I know of no objection that's been raised by the bar or by the courts.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you. Mr. Speaker, I would like to know the difference between the original bill introduced by the Alaska Bar Association and the Rules Committee bill, and I'd like to know whether or not the Bar Association now agrees with the committee substitute, as long as they were the ones that originally introduced it by request. I'd like to know how it differs.
Mr. Urien?
I knew the Bar Association had made lots of inroads into the legislature, but I didn't know they could introduce bills. Can they do that now?
Well, by request, I said.
Is there a response? Mr. Parker.
Mr. Speaker, I can only speak between the difference between the version of the bill that came from the Judiciary Committee and the Rules Committee substitute. The difference between those two bills is that Rules has added the language after page 5, line 13, to the end, the section on the eligibility to take the bar examination. Currently, as most of you know, you after graduating from an accredited law school, then you can take the bar, and if you pass it, then you'll be admitted to the Alaska bar. This would change the ground rules to this extent. You'd have to spend 1 year in an accredited law school and then 2 years clerking for an attorney who's a member of the bar in Alaska. Then, if you could pass the bar exam, you would be admitted to the bar. What was called reading the law was done, of course, in Alaska in most places until a few years ago. I should know the exact year, but I don't. There's a combination between going to law school and clerking, and if you have to have 1 year of law school and 2 years of clerking before you can take the bar, then if you can pass the bar, you'd be admitted.
Is there any other response to the inquiry? Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Speaker, in terms of the Judiciary Committee changes, I think the important ones are on page 2, line 9. It requires that there be two laypersons appointed to the Board of Governors of the Bar Association. And then on page 4, line 18, or line 19, it specifies that employees of the legislature in the performance of their duties would not be required to pass the Alaska bar exam or be members of the bar unless they were involved in appearances before the court. I think that's a significant difference over the original bill.
Another question of either Mr. Parker or the Judiciary Chairman. Does the Alaska Bar Association now agree with the changes?
Mr. Parker.
Speaker, no.
Any other comment? The question before the House is the adoption of the Rules Committee substitute. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Rules Committee substitute is adopted. Does the clerk have amendments?
Amendment number 1 by Mr. Brown. Page 4. Line 26. Change the period after Alaska to a comma and add no later than 10 months following the commencement of their employment.
Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent for the adoption of the amendment.
Objection is noted. Would the amendment be read again, please?
Amendment number 1 by Mr. Brown. Page 4, line 26. Change the period after Alaska to a comma and add no later than 10 months following the commencement of their employment, period.
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Speaker, during the Judiciary Committee deliberations on this bill that actually spanned two sessions, there was a period when I believed and told members of the committee, and I thought I was right, the position of the administration, the Attorney General's office, was that they have no objection to our doing this as a matter of exercise of our powers over certain functions of the executive branch, which are quite constitutional. And Mr. Speaker, later on I found out that while the Attorney General had no objection to it as a matter of policy, he was very upset to find out that this particular language was there, because then he could never hire anybody to start with. I guess the normal practice is that they hire a new attorney who then does get involved in work, and under supervision of someone else is it admitted to practice under waivers under the Alaska bar rules, under the usual procedure provided for by the Supreme Court, and then he becomes admitted to practice law. This amendment would essentially provide a space of time from the time that a new attorney was hired by the Department of Law for him to essentially do his studying for the bar and still be able to function within the department as an employee without proscribing his employment until he became admitted. If he didn't make it within 10 months, they'd have to dump him out and try with somebody else or something like that, because apparently he didn't pass the bar. I urge the passage of the amendment.
Chair make an inquiry, perhaps, to Mr. Brown? Under present law, is the Attorney General required to be a lawyer?
Mr. Speaker, I'm going to avoid answering that question because I don't know if I know the answer. There is an interesting parallel question as to whether or not even members of the United States Supreme Court must constitutionally be lawyers, and there was a time when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was considering appointing the younger Senator Robert La Follette to the court just to keep the Senate happy in 1944, according to Justice Douglas. He later relented and appointed a lawyer. And of course, when you address constitutional questions like that, there's some question about it. The Attorney General's position is created constitutionally, but it does not say that he's supposed to be a lawyer, so perhaps the same question applies. This does not relate to a constitutional question. It relates to our powers as a matter of policy to dictate what certain things can or cannot be done within the executive departments. In that situation, we do have the power. The Department of Law does not contest it. They even agree with doing this as a matter of policy. They just want some time to, get their guys in and admit to the bar.
I was just curious if this locked us in to appoint a lawyer as Attorney General. Mr. Not.
I just wanted to ask, does the Attorney General have to be a lawyer?
Mr. Cooper.
Mr. Speaker, I don't know whether he does or not, but I wanted to...